Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Economist.
In London, this is The Economist. I'm Anne McElvoy, senior editor, and you're listening to The Economist Asks. I'm joined in the studio by Edward Carr, our deputy editor. Our guest for this programme is Neil Ferguson, professor of history at Harvard University and senior research fellow of the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Neil is author of a new book, Kissinger, 1923 to 1968, The Idealist. So, Neil, The Economist asks, why is Henry Kissinger, of all people, an idealist?
Most people think of Kissinger as the arch realist. Realism in the sense of doing whatever it takes to advance the national interest, amoral, immoral, illegal, inhumane. Writing the first half of Kissinger's life down to the moment at which he's offered the national security advisor job by Richard Nixon, I was very struck by how little this description matched the man I was getting to know in the archives. He comes across as an idealist in at least three ways. He's critical of the policy of appeasement, which I guess he grew up under, as being supposedly tough realism that went horribly wrong. He immerses himself in idealism, studying Kant at Harvard. And then he's an anti-materialist who rejects not only Marxism-Leninism, but all the capitalist theories of economic determinism that were doing the rounds. So he's an idealist on at least three counts.
I've promised everyone I'm not going to dwell on Kant for too long. A terrible risk. But give me a sense of what that Kantian idealism might mean. Is it simply that you understand that there has to be authority in the state and in world affairs and that morality can't exist outside it? Or is it some other relationship with German thought?
I wouldn't say that. Kissinger's reading in The Meaning of History, which is this enormously long undergraduate senior thesis he wrote, is that there's a tension in Kant's thought between the idea that the ultimate destination of human history is perpetual peace and the experience of freedom that Kissinger sees as being the more important idea at the heart of Kant's philosophy, that this is something that is real to us. We experience freedom when we make choices. And Kissinger's argument is that's not an illusion. Even if there is some ultimate destination at the point of decision, in our minds, we are free. And in that sense, Kissinger translates this very explicitly into a political context. The Cold War is not a struggle in his mind between two rival economic systems, one of which will turn out to be more productive than the other. He says in the senior thesis, we should reject totalitarianism even if it is the more economically efficient system, because this idea of freedom is the more important. It's the higher thing.
Edward Carr, you've reviewed the book and looked at that tussle in Henry Kissinger's thinking. Did it convince you that idealist is, however counterintuitively, the right tag to apply to him?
When I looked at how Kissinger spoke about those sorts of ideals, and then actually later on in his last book on world order, wrote about the ideals that are embodied in American political culture, it came across to me as someone who saw them as tools to deploy. They're things that are created in the political culture in which he was living. And he was aware that to counter Soviet power, you needed to sell an idealism. It wasn't enough just to sell, as Neil was saying, prosperity. So I find myself wondering whether Kissinger used these tools as a means of getting power and of exercising his power in the world, rather than being a committed idealist who put them before everything else.
We sometimes think of idealists in a more popular sense as being guitar-strumming, head-in-the-clouds utopians. Well, clearly Kissinger's not that kind of an idealist. But I don't see in him the power-grabbing, ambitious, conniving Kissinger that people have subsequently projected back onto his early life. I mean, he may well have become those things once he entered the realm of power. When he's thinking about Cold War issues, which is what Rockefeller asks him to advise on, he tends to take the idealist side. Let me give you a couple of examples. Briefly, Kissinger was in the Kennedy administration. He was a minor player. The big issues of the Kennedy administration's foreign policy were the Berlin Crisis, 61, and then Cuba the following year. On both occasions, Kissinger concluded that Kennedy had done a grubby deal with the Soviets. He would not have been as acquiescent in the building of the Berlin Wall had he had a powerful role in the administration, and he wouldn't have done the missile swap that ended the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I see, not only in theory but in practice, the young Kissinger as idealist, almost in the sense of Woodrow Wilson, and almost putting issues like self-determination over the narrow national interest.
You dwelt on his young life and the development of his thinking quite a long time at the beginning of the book. Did you have any doubts about that and whether you should sort of crack on with it to the point where he starts to become the power mensch? Or did you feel that was so important in the way that we understand or don't understand Henry Kissinger?
Well, this first of two volumes covers the first half of his life pretty much exactly in chronological terms. I felt that previous writers had neglected or got positively wrong his early life. One key issue is, what's the formative experience? I don't think it's being in his early teens under Hitler, and he's always denied that. He makes the point that he's a teenager. He leaves at 15. His big interest was football. He wasn't at all political. You only get the first glimmers of political engagement at that stage. What really shaped him was the war. And I think the fact that Kissinger was a soldier, saw action at the Battle of the Bulge, came under very lethal German shellfire, would probably have been shot if he'd been taken prisoner, and then goes into counterintelligence. These are pretty important parts of the story. Think of what he subsequently says when he goes to Vietnam in 1965 and realizes things are going horribly wrong. He says, what's become of the American army? It's degenerated. He'd also, by the way, spent time in Korea. So he knew war, and he'd seen it at the sharp end. And the other key event, which I think must have had a formative experience, was witnessing the liberation of a concentration camp, Alem, just outside Hanover. The short essay he wrote about that experience, which he gave the title The Eternal Jew, is one of the most extraordinary documents that I quote in the book. And for a man who lost his religious faith in the war at some point, broke with his deeply Orthodox Jewish father over the issue, the experience nevertheless of witnessing the Holocaust, seeing what totalitarianism was capable of, discovering not long after that 13 at least of his family members had died too, including his grandmother, that cannot fail to have shaped his outlook. And I think there's a pretty seamless transition from Kissinger the soldier, counterintelligence officer, anti-Nazi, Nazi hunter, which is essentially what he was after he transitioned to the counterintelligence corps, to Kissinger the cold warrior. There's even a moment when he encounters the Red Army at the River Elbe at the end of the war. He sees for the first time there's another totalitarian state and it's not going to be our ally for much longer.
That period, particularly leading up to 1968, when he starts to come into his own, Ed, it's quite surprising in a way that he sort of doesn't move towards Nixon earlier, and as Neil has mentioned, he sticks with Rockefeller. You could say it's part of the idealism or even a naivety, but in that 1960s, the Berlin Wall has gone up, the Cuba crisis has happened. What did you make of the account of his thinking at that time and how he sort of shifts to becoming the famous Henry Kissinger, if you like?
Well, one of the things that comes across is a slightly European attitude to powerful people. I mean, I think he admires Rockefeller's wealth and aristocratic noblesse oblige, and he thinks that Rockefeller can do things as an accomplished and wealthy man.
Is it always clear to Kissinger himself which side he's on in terms of party allegiance? You mentioned that he has a minor role in the Kennedy administration, and although he's critical of Kennedy's handling of the Bay of Pigs, he kind of goes along in the end with the view, well, you know what, we're all still here and it could have ended differently. So he's at the same time thought of as being more of a figure on the right with a defining role in conservative America, which is he?
Well, he certainly thought of himself as a conservative at Harvard compared with liberal contemporaries like Arthur Schlesinger Jr., the historian who was a friend. But when he meets real conservatives, for example, at the 1964 Republican National Convention, he's absolutely appalled. The Goldwaterites, the supporters of Barry Goldwater, who boo and jeer Rockefeller when he tries to speak at the convention, appall Kissinger to the extent that he compares them with fascists. I think the interesting thing about Kissinger is that although he sees himself as a conservative, going back to something Edward just said, he sees himself as a European conservative. In the American context, he's much more bipartisan. And it's almost happenstance that he ends up in Nixon's administration. That's a complete surprise when it happens, because Kissinger doesn't expect anything like that. When he's first offered the job by Nixon, he doesn't realize he's being offered the job.
But are they, Edward, also united in the end by the fact that, oh, it has to be subliminal in the way that Americans are conducting foreign policy? But we discover from Neil's book that Nixon's doubts about Vietnam seem to go back perhaps further than a lot of other accounts have reflected. What did you make of that?
Well, I thought that it was tantalising, the glimpse you got of these two men beginning to dance around each other right at the end of the book. And you know, I'm for one, can't wait to see how they get on in the second volume, knowing particularly how their relationship's being characterised by other writers. A strange mixture of sycophancy and resentment on Kissinger's part and sort of, you know, the usual paranoia from Nixon. And to see kind of how these two characters evolve, especially now that we have this picture of Kissinger as an intellectual, as a man of ideas, who wants to get things done and sort of who believes that you live off this capital that you've amassed when you're actually in office.
The convergence of Kissinger and Nixon is a fascinating thing. It's an intellectual convergence. As I said, Kissinger's avoiding Nixon, badmouths him, says he's unfit to be president, but Nixon is reading Kissinger. So when they meet in late 1967, unusually, it's Nixon who's able to break the social ice by saying how much he had enjoyed Kissinger's earlier book, Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy. But one of the striking things about this convergence is the role that Vietnam plays in it. Kissinger realizes very early on that Vietnam's a disaster. He goes there in 1965, and as I mentioned earlier, he's dismayed by what he sees. He's also dismayed by the Saigon government's corruption. And he concludes pretty quickly there's going to have to be a diplomatic way out of this. The puzzle is how. How do you get the United States out of this amazing mess that Lyndon Johnson's administration has created? And this is the point, I think, at which Kissinger begins to temper his own idealism. Through a rather strange historical refraction, it's thinking about Bismarck that gets him closer, I think, to strategic realism. It's asking the question, okay, Bismarck was no idealist. In fact, there's something very problematic about his rather amoral approach to statecraft. But you know what? Wasn't he doing something right in the way that he conducted European policy?
You're thinking of balance of power politics.
Exactly. And I think this idea of equilibrium, but also of strategic ingenuity, comes out of the unfinished, unpublished Bismarck book and is really a cue to bring Nixon and Kissinger together on this problem.
But you also say, Neil, that originally Kissinger's project was to write three books about starting from the Treaty of Vienna and going on through to the catastrophe of the First World War, and about how this balance of power politics was ultimately doomed for one reason or another. So when Kissinger begins to embrace this, is he doing it in the knowledge that it can't work in the long run?
He has this essay on Bismarck, which is ultimately critical. This is the part of the book that he publishes, saying there's something unsustainable about this tour de force that relies on Bismarck's genius, but is essentially a sort of Darwinian, morally unhooked strategy. I think this is a kind of anticipation of the problems that Nixon and Kissinger are going to have extricating the United States from Vietnam, because what they have to do is elaborate strategic gymnastics, the opening to China, the pressure that puts in the Soviets, all ultimately designed to extricate the US from its mess in Vietnam. So it's strategic ingenuity, which Kissinger hopes to reconcile with his youthful idealism. Hopes.
But there are some people who will be going into this, and they won't all be on the far left, just saying, you know, this man has blood on his hands. When you're going, particularly from where you are now, into your research and writing of the second volume, how much is that in your mind? There is a case to answer here. To an extent, your subject is still in the dock.
The critical issue, it seems to me, is to make sure that we have a single standard, not a double standard, for judging US administrations during the Cold War and indeed after the Cold War, when, for example, people exercise themselves about the US administration's involvement in Chile at the time that the Allende government was overthrown and Pinochet's military dictatorship established. They need to remind themselves before they pick up their dusty copy of Christopher Hitchens and start crying war crime that something very similar has just happened in Egypt. A country which is a military dictatorship. Previously, the democratic leader was arrested, has just been sentenced to death, and US military aid to Egypt was restored earlier this year. So my objective in the second volume is clearly not to paint with whitewash. I haven't done that in the first volume, and I won't in the second. But I do think we need to have a single standard for assessing these sorts of questions. Kissinger says, in foreign policy, most choices are between evils. You don't get nice touchy-feely options. And that's important to remember.
We're in a world now where we're seeing a resurgent Russia and the Ukraine crisis, indeed Crimea, that's gone along with that, and also Syria in a multi-sided mess that the world seems unable to do much about. Do you think that Henry Kissinger might have some solutions or perhaps some pointers that would help us with that?
We have reasonably good answers to that question because he's written a lot on these subjects. I'll give you a very short answer. It is hard to imagine Henry Kissinger allowing the Russian president to become the power broker of a Middle Eastern crisis. I mean, almost rule number one of Cold War strategy was make sure the Russians don't get into that position. And that was one of Nixon and Kissinger's early successes, really marginalizing the Soviets in the Middle Eastern crisis of the early 1970s. So what we're seeing at the moment play out in the Middle East and perhaps also to an extent in Eastern Europe is a fail by the standards of Henry Kissinger.
Neil Ferguson, Edward Carr, thank you both very much. You've been listening to The Economist Asks. In London, this is The Economist.
The Economist.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org, paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.